Science fiction has a view of the future that tends to be pretty bleak, doesn't it? There's been a pandemic or a nuclear war. Most of humanity is wiped out. Armed vigilantes steal your stuff and eat your family. The good news is you can survive all this if you have the knowledge. That's the title of a new book by NASA astrobiologist Lewis Dartnell. The subtitle, How to Rebuild Our World from Scratch. It's a list of everything we'd need to know to reboot. And if that seems overly optimistic, Lewis told Charles Monroe Kane he expects rationality and morality will prevail, even after the apocalypse.
I'm not naive, and clearly, with the evaporation of law and order, things will get brutal and unpleasant, and there'll be a great deal of violence, and the strong will try to dominate the weak. But, I mean, there have been dissolutions of society and law and order in history, and things recover, and an equilibrium is reached, and kind of normality ensues. And so all of these post-apocalyptic films or kind of sci-fi books that we've read, we're familiar with this trope. We've all seen I Am Legend or
right.
The Road. We know about that kind of period. But no one ever talks about what comes next.
You've had this collapse
of civilization. You've had that period of brutality. People are now in a stable society, ready to start trying to recover and, you know, retrieve the capability that we had before. So how do you build a civilization from scratch?
You're an astrobiologist, and you've written this amazingly dense book that's practical on how to survive post-apocalypse. Why?
It's something that interests me. So I'm a scientist. I'm a research scientist. I work in a lab. And you're right, my primary research is in astrobiology and understanding the limits of survival of life on Earth and comparing that to the environment we think used to exist on Mars, and therefore whether there's a possibility of life on Mars and what signs of life to look for and how we could detect it. But that's not so far from thinking about the very fundamentals, not of life, but of civilization. What does civilization require? What conditions does it need? How does it provide for itself in the way that life might provide for itself? So yeah, I don't see them as being two completely distinct things. Like, they have been useful kind of with each other to a certain extent.
One thing your book gets at, which kind of scared me more than anything else,
yeah,
is that there's a possibility that we could lose that collective knowledge. And you get into talking about not just storing canned goods or learning how to make your own soap, but storing knowledge and actually the idea of the collective knowledge we need, our future selves need, to survive. Where did that come from? Where's the idea that we need to do that? Because I'm also surprised that we don't do that.
As you're saying, the reason for this is that over history, as civilization has complexified and become more sophisticated, each of us have become ever more specialized and focused in the kind of niche, in the role we perform in civilization. And you get kind of, you know, layer built upon layer. You get this vast kind of pyramid of kind of roles building on each other. And this wasn't true, you know, hundreds of years ago, and perhaps during the mid-1300s, when the Black Death, the bubonic plague, raged across Europe and killed perhaps a third of the population at the time. And it could have been a truly cataclysmic civilization-ending event, but it wasn't. It kind of retarded us a bit. But people kind of brushed themselves off and just got on with life, because back then they did have all of these practical skills and experience and the expertise to make things for themselves and do things for themselves.
Yeah, they were closer to the basics.
Exactly, closer to the means of production, closer to growing food for themselves and stitching their own clothes and using a spinning wheel and a loom. I mean, how many of us have actually ever seen a loom or a spinning wheel with our own eyes rather than just a picture on Wikipedia? I mean, I certainly hadn't. And that's what's interesting, has been interesting me while I've been researching this, is that kind of disconnect that I think every one of us in the modern world feels, this kind of slight sense of dissatisfaction that we don't really have any idea anymore how any of this stuff is done for us. It just magically appears on the supermarket shelves or on the clothes in a shopping store. And I think people are interested. And the one thing I hope that people take away after reading the knowledge is just a little bit more appreciation about how all this stuff is done for us. And that incredible, those kind of processes and principles that support all of our everyday lives without us really realizing it.
What do we need to know, theoretically? Not how to use a bellows or how to use a sextet, but what do we need to know theoretically that we really need, that's imperative to have after an apocalypse? What are the theories and ideas that we must bring forward?
I allowed myself about 300 pages for the knowledge to condense it down. Let's say you had only a few pages you could preserve and transmit to the society that came after us, just a few pages of text. What would you describe? What would you explain? And if I were kind of forced, for that, you know, limited to that very tight word count, I think the greatest invention of them all, the one thing you would try to preserve above all others, would be the scientific method, that this machinery for generating new knowledge. And be sure that the scientific method is an invention as much as anything else, as much as any kind of steam engine or kind of chemical process. It wasn't done centuries ago. It had to be developed and invented. Because it's by that process of the scientific method, applying that machinery, that we've built the modern world, that we've created antibiotics and aircraft and machinery and this wonderfully successful system of agriculture and transport. And so if you want to recover all of those things and, you know, kind of improve the human condition so you're not scrapping around in the mud again, you're going to have to apply the scientific method to recover as quickly as possible.
Do you feel like there's other theories that just are, if you only have 20 pages, you better know this other detail after this detail?
I mean, some knowledge is more directly applicable to saving yourself and helping yourself. And then that's the kind of knowledge that I focused on in the book. And if you were limited to only one single notion to tell the people in the immediate aftermath, to try and keep them as healthy and keep them alive as best you can, it would be this idea of the germ theory, that the notion that the reason people get sick and transmit diseases to each other is not because, you know, the fractious will of some whimsical god, or because of bad air, because of, you know, malaria, literally bad air. It's because there are things which are so small you cannot see them with your own eyes. They're invisibly small, these bacteria, these microbes, and they get inside your body and they make you sick. And I explain how to make a very, very rudimentary microscope to see these
for
yourself. You can generally do this in your own kitchen if you wanted to. You can make a very simple microscope to see these germs. And with that understanding, and then the basis, therefore, of hygiene and sanitation, the idea that you want to not get bacteria get into your body, you want to absolutely break the kind of pathogen cycle between your own excrement and getting it inside your body, the kind of fecal-oral transfer, it's called. And even in the kind of mid-1800s, the kind of mid-19th century, when London was the capital city of the most powerful empire in the world, people were still literally pouring their poo into the Thames, into the river, and then someone was dipping a bucket 20 yards down, pulling out, drawing that water and drinking it. And you'd get cholera outbreaks, killing hundreds, thousands of people each time, because they didn't have that really simple understanding of transmissible diseases and germs. And you could leapfrog, you know, hundreds of years, centuries of kind of development by just explaining that principle to someone, and more, as importantly, showing them how to demonstrate it for themselves, how to build a basic microscope.
You know, it's funny you say that, because one of the things I liked about your book was you're like, look, we can have 20/20 hindsight here. This is the future. Mm. We can look back and say, future guys, this wheelbarrow is going to be really useful for you. You should do this.
So really simple things, exactly, that were developed surprisingly late in history. And it's just such a, in retrospect, it seems so obvious, but it's only obvious once you know it. And just like I said, with a few hints, you can really help accelerate a progression.
You know, I wonder, even if we were rebooted back to 10,000 years ago, is our path inevitable, technologically and scientifically speaking, and we're just going to make the same mistakes? We're going to make the same rubber tires and the splitting of the atoms and the same pollution and the same alienation, because it seems like that's what we're going to do.
I mean, I don't know. I suppose in one sense, we've only got one example, one civilization, which has had widespread problems of global warming, of creating a different environment on the planet, because we've had that capability, and we've invented nuclear weapons, and we are so advanced, we're almost too strong for ourselves, almost too advanced for ourselves, that we are creating some problems, some serious problems for ourselves. So we've only really got one example. And if you were to kind of, you know, rewind the DVD of civilization and watch the film from the beginning again, if you were to hit the reboot button and start from scratch, I don't think you can say that it's inevitable. It happened once, but, you know, it could happen completely different a second time around. Perhaps something would be different about society second time around, where they might take a more responsible attitude and not, let's say, kind of start over-exploiting resources. But then again, maybe we will. Maybe there's something inherent about humanity, that we're individualistic and we look out for ourselves first and foremost. And a lot of the problems of the kind of modern world, I think, with, you know, kind of pollution and overusing resources, are what's known in game theory as the tragedy of the commons, that you look out for yourself, you put your own interests above the interests of the community, even knowing that if the whole thing crashes, you have as much difficulty as everyone else afterwards, if you see what I mean. And that's the situation we're kind of finding ourselves in today. And I don't know if it would repeat itself if you went back to scratch. I don't want to run that experiment, of course, because I quite like modern civilization. But again, I think it's a really interesting philosophical point that you could argue quite effectively on both sides, I think.
Lewis Dartnell is an astrobiologist and author of The Knowledge, How to Rebuild Our World from Scratch. Charles Monroe Kane spoke with him.